morning, brothers and sisters, is by our brother Ron Abel, speaking on the subject, The Great False Church. Today's study number 5 is entitled, The Little Horn in Daniel 7. Brother Ron.
Brothers and sisters, if we turn to Daniel chapter 7, we have the description here of the wild beasts representing political powers, and finally the little horn. We read of these beasts in Daniel chapter 7. Reading at verse 2, Daniel said, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. And four great beasts came up out of the sea, different from one another. The first was like a lion, and had eagle's wings. Then as I looked, its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the ground, and made to stand upon 2 feet like a man. And the mind of a man was given to it. And behold, another beast, a second one, like a bear. It was raised up on one side. It had 3 ribs in its mouth, between its teeth. And it was told, Arise, devour much flesh. And after this I looked, and lo, another like a leopard, with 4 wings of a bird on its back. And the beast had 4 heads, and dominion was given to it. Now we'd like to review our information, this time not from the wild beasts of Daniel chapter 7, but from the image, the great image, that we have in Daniel chapter 2. And in this great image, we have the head of gold that represented the Babylonian power, as you see here, and the years of its duration. This was followed by the breast and arms of silver depicting the Medo-Persian power, the belly and thighs of brass representing Greece, and finally we have the legs of iron representing Rome. And then we come to the feet, the divided state of iron and clay, representing the divided kingdoms of men. Now it's important to see that what we have in Daniel chapter 7 is really a mirror of what we have in Daniel chapter 2. And Daniel chapter 2 provides the spinal column, as it were, for all of the prophecies that occur in the Bible. The wild beast that we have listed for us and described in Daniel chapter 7 have peculiar descriptions that have significance in terms of the prophecies. These wild beasts were different from one another because God, through his prophet, is describing characteristics of political powers that are best represented by the beasts which he selected. And so we have the Assyrio-Babylonian lion. It comes with the other beasts from the Great Sea, from the Mediterranean area. The beasts were different from one another because they represented different aspects of their political dominion. In the case of the lion, it was given eagle's wings, depicting its swift rise to power. And of course, when the wings were plucked off, it represented the demise or the loss of the power. The lion was lifted up from the earth, indicating divine intervention in the affairs of the kingdom of Babylon. And the lion was made to stand on its feet, given a change in political posture as a result of divine intervention through Nebuchadnezzar, and it was given the mind of a man. However, the Babylonian power, with the passage of time, was replaced by the bear, this large, awkward, clumsy creature, representing the sprawling empire of the Medes and the Persians. And the bear, as we know, was raised on one side, indicating the way media came to power first. We see that the bear had three ribs in its mouth, indicating the three defeated powers of Babylon, Lydus, and Egypt. And this power was told to arise and devour much flesh, indicating the conquering enterprises of the Medo-Persian bear. The Medo-Persian bear was followed by the leopard, a four-winged leopard with four heads. And the leopard indicated the swiftness of the Grecian power. And the wings of a bird indicated the swiftness of the armies of the Grecian power under Alexander the Great. And upon his death in a drunken orgy, the kingdom of Greece, the dominion of Greece, was divided among the four leaders of his army, and therefore it became a divided kingdom. And this brings us to the position now where we can consider the fourth beast of Daniel's vision, which is described in verse 7. After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, terrible and dreadful and exceedingly strong. And it had great iron teeth. It devoured and broke in pieces and stamped the residue with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. Now this is, of course, the Roman Empire depicted as a diverse beast, because there was no wild creature that the Lord God had made that could be compared in ferocity with this beast with its teeth of iron and claws of bronze. This perhaps is the power that the Apostle Paul alluded to when he spoke of being delivered from the mouth of a lion. Or when the Apostle Peter said, "Be sober, be watchful. Your adversary, your antidikos, your opponent at law, your Roman magistrate, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking some to devour. Resist him firm in your faith, knowing that the same experience of suffering is required of your brotherhood throughout the world." And so there indeed were periods of terrible persecution in which the believers under Nero were dressed in skins of wild animals and made to fight with dogs, when they were crucified, when they were boiled in pitch and lit as torches. So we have this fourth creature, diverse from the rest, and an exceedingly fierce creature. And now we see the sequence then to the beasts of Daniel chapter 7. These four great sea beasts that Daniel sees in his night vision. We have noted the Babylonian with the wings of an eagle, the clumsy Medo-Persian bear with the three ribs in his mouth, the fast-moving leopard with the wings of a bird, which later became a four-headed empire. And then we come to the Roman power, this diverse beast with its teeth of iron and claws of bronze, that in a later stage would give rise to 10 horns, or 10 political entities, which would spring up from the Roman Empire, and which would then be followed in turn by a stout horn that was smaller than its fellows. It would have eyes and it would have a mouth that would speak great things. Now Daniel describes this in verse 7 when he says that it devoured and broke in pieces and stamped the residue with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. "I considered the horns," said Daniel, "and behold, there came up among them another horn." So in period of time, the chronology seems to be the diverse beast giving rise to 10 horns, and then at some period later there would be a little horn, before which three of the first horns were plucked up by the roots, and behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things. Now it's easy to become confused in Daniel, because in Daniel chapter 7 we have horns that are depicted there, speaking of political powers, And this is true when we look at Daniel chapter 8. This is the way the diverse beasts is usually depicted in the Chrysadelphian drawings. The Roman Empire is depicted by a beast that looks much like a dragon. And here you see the 10 horns and the little horn arising before which 3 horns were uprooted. But in chapter 8 of the book of Daniel, there is another horn described in verse 9. Previous to the description of this horn, there is also a battle that's described between a billy goat and before a ram. But we're not going to spend any time with this. Just to note that in verse 5, I was considering, behold, a he-goat, or a billy goat, came from the west across the face of the whole earth without touching the ground, and the goat had a conspicuous horn between his eyes. That's Alexander the Great, no doubt. And he came to the Medo-Persian ram with the 2 horns which I had seen standing on the bank of the river. So we see there is a conflict between the billy goat, the Grecian billy goat, with Alexander the Great, the chief horn, and he fights this Medo-Persian ram. And we read in verse 8, then the he-goat magnified himself exceedingly, but when he was strong, the great horn was broken. And instead of it, there came up 4 conspicuous horns toward the 4 winds of heaven. Well, we've seen the counterpart to this billy goat here with 4 horns, with the 4-headed leopard in Daniel chapter 7. And so Daniel chapter 8 is really dealing with the eastern part of the Roman Empire, and Daniel chapter 7 is dealing with the western part of the Roman Empire. Now, this horn that comes up, we read in chapter 8, there is a horn that really grows out of a horn. Now, this transparency is not very clear, but what is being depicted here is the 4 horns off on the side here, and then we have the horn that grows out of one of these horns, and this is a dominion of the horn as it develops, because we read of it in verse 9. Out of one of them came forth a little horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, as you see here, toward Egypt, toward the east, toward the glorious land, and it grew great even to the host of heaven, and some of the host of the stars it cast down to the ground and trampled upon them. It magnified itself even to the prince of the host, and the continual burnt offering was taken away from him, and the place of his sanctuary was overthrown. Now, it's not our purpose now to spend much time on this depiction of the eastern part of the empire with the horn that grows out of part of the Grecian Empire. But it's very interesting to note a comment on here by Gibbon. Now, Gibbon says, on the same spot a temple, referring to St. Peter's Basilica in Rome, which far surpasses the ancient glories of the capital, has been erected by the Christian pontiffs, who, deriving their claim of universal dominion from the humble fishermen of Galilee, have succeeded to the throne of the Caesars, given laws to the barbarian conquerors of Rome, and extended their spiritual jurisdiction from the coast of the Baltic to the shores of the Pacific Ocean. So what we really have here is an identification of the popes of Rome, which are essentially the same in their power that they exercise as the Rome of the Caesars. And when the Rome of the Caesars disappears, then we have this little horn that continues many of the aspects of this beast down through the years of history. Now let us focus our attention on this little horn now more specifically. First of all, let us familiarize ourselves with the details of this little horn that we read of in Daniel chapter 7. We have here a rather graphic depiction. Perhaps if the lights were turned out, we could see this maybe a little clearer. God very often depicted political powers by beasts, as we will see in a minute. But this fourth Roman beast that we have depicted here is described as we mentioned, with its teeth of iron and its claws of bronze. It was different, it was terrible, it devoured, it broke in pieces, and it stamped the residue. And so the dominion of this fourth beast is followed by the arising in its place of 10 kingdoms, represented by these 10 horns that you see here on the head of the fourth beast. With the passage of time, however, there is a horn that is more stout than his fellows. It has a superiority over all of the other horns in that it has the eyes of a man, and it has a mouth. And the mouth of this little horn is such that it speaks great things against the Most High. Now, Daniel describes this little horn elsewhere in chapter 7, and I'll read this from verse 20. And concerning the 10 horns that were on its head, and the other horn which came up, and before which 3 of them fell, the horn which had eyes and a mouth that spoke great things, and which seemed greater than its fellows. As I looked, this horn made war with the saints, and prevailed over them, until the Ancient of Days came, and judgment was given for the saints of the Most High, and the time came when the saints received the kingdom. And now note carefully the description of this stout little horn as we read of it in Daniel chapter 7. Thus he said, as for the fourth beast, there shall be a fourth kingdom on earth, paralleling that section of Nebuchadnezzar's image, the leg section of iron, which shall be different from all the kingdoms, and it shall devour the whole earth, and trample it down, and break it to pieces. As for the 10 horns, out of this kingdom 10 horns shall arise. The sequence is important. The chronology here is that we have the beast first, then the 10 horns arise. And then later, another shall arise after them. He shall be different from the former ones, with the obvious advantage of his eyes that he can see with, his mouth that he can speak great things with. It's an ecclesiastical as well as a political horn. And he shall put down 3 kings. He shall speak words against the Most High, and shall wear out the saints of the Most High, and shall think to change the times and the law, and they shall be given into his hand for a time, 2 times, and 1/2 time. But the court shall sit in judgment, and his dominion shall be taken away, to be consumed and destroyed to the end. And the kingdom and the dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High. Their kingdom shall be an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey them. Now notice, brothers and sisters, that although this beast is depicted, symbolically depicting and representing features of the Roman Empire, have you ever thought about the way in which this fourth beast of Daniel chapter 7 really has counterparts elsewhere in the New Testament? For example, you probably recognize this figure from the description that we have in the Revelation. In Revelation chapter 12, in a passage that's used very often by religionists to prove the existence of a supernatural devil, John says, a great portent appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet. And then he sees another portent in heaven. Behold, a great red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 diadems upon his heads. And his tail swept down 1/3 of the stars of heaven. So we can at once recognize that some of the imagery employed in Revelation chapter 12 goes back to Daniel chapter 7, which in turn has its real foundation in Daniel chapter 2, which is the Christadelphian and I believe the biblical spinal cord for all of the major prophecies of this kind in the Bible. And then there is another beast that appears. We see the 10 horns on this great red dragon with 7 heads. But in Revelation chapter 13, we're introduced to yet another beast. And of this beast we read, "And I saw a beast rising out of the sea," quite a parallel again with Daniel chapter 7, with ten horns and 7 heads, with 10 diadems upon its horns, and a blasphemous name upon its heads. And the beast that I saw was like a leopard." That's interesting, because we have just been reading about the leopard. And so this beast that we believe depicts the papacy in chapter 13 is really a composite beast, because it includes the elements of all those pagan world empires. "And so the beast I saw was like a leopard, with aspects of pagan Greece. Its feet were like a bear's, employing some of the characteristics of the clumsy, awkward, yet devouring Medo-Persian bear. And its mouth was like a lion's mouth," taking us back to the Babylonian lion. "And to it the dragon gave his power." Well, we've seen a picture of what the dragon was like. And so when we look at Daniel, brothers and sisters, we are really seeing this continual historical depiction of the Almighty, we believe, through the course of history, depicting various features of the apostasy of the great false church in the cameo of the chaste virgins who have not defiled themselves with women. So we have the apostate woman, the harlot figure who rides the beast, and we have this pure, chaste virgin. And back in Daniel chapter 7, we have this fourth beast, the elements of which flow through chapter 12 and chapter 13 of the last book of the Bible. Now, if we can have the lights, we will return now to Daniel chapter 7 to look a little closer at some of the features of this Daniel 7 prophecy. In Daniel chapter 7, we have characteristics that we can identify about this fourth beast and the horns as we had in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. And it's the work of the imaginative, and I suppose the creative Bible student, to sit down with his 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, the thing that can be known easily, devoid of the apocalyptic imagery that we have in Daniel chapter 7, to provide the simple, the non-symbolic, by which we then look at the symbolic, the more difficult sections of Scripture, to see the comparisons that we have between this little horn in Daniel chapter 7 and the man of sin in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. And it's really interesting, brothers and sisters, that of the 22 interested friends that came out last night to hear the public lecture, I had the pleasure of talking with 4 of them in the dining area. And it was remarkable that these 4 individuals that we chatted with had all read the late great Planet Earth by Hal Lindsey, had all adopted the rapture theory, and all believed in the Antichrist. So you see, our topic, the Great False Church, is a very relevant topic. And unless we can approach these passages in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 and Daniel chapter 7, we may be very ineffective in speaking with these, our interested friends, who have read sometimes Daniel chapter 7 and 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, to depict for them the future Antichrist who will be installed in Jerusalem. So it very much affects our capability to witness today, to have an understanding of these sections of the prophetic scriptures. In Daniel chapter 7, there are some characteristics of this little horn that we have listed here. We have noted that it was greater than the 10, because it was an ecclesiastical horn. It had eyes, and we only have to think of the way in which the priests of the papal system, who are respected, venerated, and revered as if in fact they were God in places of the world, seeking out information, acting as an informant for the Vatican, by which it can further its ambitions and interests toward world domination. And so the horn with its Jesuit eyes, its Dominican eyes, its informants, continued to spread its influence throughout the Roman Empire. And it had a mouth indeed which spoke great things. In fact, it spoke things against the Most High. We only have to think of some of the statements that the papists have made about the position of the Pope to realize that they have indeed spoken great things against the Most High. The priest is the man of God, the minister of God. He that despiseth the priest despiseth God. He that hears him hears God. The priest remits sin as God. It is clear that their function is such that none greater can be conceived. Wherefore they are justly called not only angels, but also God, holding as they do among us the power and authority of the immortal God. This is a Roman Catholic writing describing the Council of Trent. The Pope is of so great a dignity and so exalted that he is not a mere man, but as it were God and the vicar of God. The Pope is, as it were, God on earth, chief of kings, having plenitude of power. Into this fold of Jesus Christ no one can enter if not under the guidance of the sovereign pontiff. And men can securely reach salvation only when they are united with him, since the Roman pontiff is the vicar of Christ and represents his person on earth. Pope John the 23rd, 1958. So you see, brothers and sisters, the papal horn indeed was a horn which spoke words against the Most High. And the papal horn then began to wear out the saints of the Most High. We have only to think of the torture methods, to think of the persecution down through the ages, to see the way in which the papal system wore out the saints of the Most High, and shall think to change the times and the law. This man of lawlessness that exalted himself above every so-called God or object of worship, and the papal head would be given this dominion. The saints of the Most High would suffer this wearing out from him for a time depicted here as a time, two times and half a time. Chapter 7, we are introduced to a term that's rather difficult for us to understand, because it is generally accepted that a time was 360 days. So 360 days equals one time. In Daniel here we read that they would be given into the hand of this opposing, powerful little horn system for 3.5 times. So we have then 360, 360, and a half a time, which is 180, which gives us 1,260 days. Now it is here that the Bible student experiences a difficulty. How should he understand the duration of this period through which the horn would wear out the saint to the Most High? Would it be for a literal 1,260 days? Well, there really is no historical counterpart to a literal 1,260 days. And as was noted in our question period yesterday, often in the Bible there is a principle, a day for a year. In Numbers chapter 14, we have several illustrations of this in the scripture, some of which we'll allude to now, setting forth the principle that in prophecy sometimes one day equals one year. In Numbers chapter 14 and verse 32, we read, "But as for you, your dead bodies shall fall in this wilderness, and your children shall be shepherds in the wilderness 40 years. And shall suffer for your faithlessness until the last of your dead bodies lies in the wilderness, according to the number of the days in which you spied out the land, 40 days, for every year a day, for every day a year, you shall bear your iniquity, 40 years, and you shall know my displeasure." In Ezekiel chapter 4 and verse 6, The day for a year principle is set out again. Ezekiel is told, "And when you have completed these, you shall lie down a second time, but on your right side, and bear the punishment of the house of Judah. 40 days I assign you, a day for a year." In Daniel, we have the 70 weeks prophecy of Daniel chapter 9 and verse 24. 70 weeks of years are decreed concerning your people. 70 weeks of years would give you 490 days. That period, 490 days, we are told, are decreed concerning your people and your holy city to finish the transgression, to put an end to sin, and to atone for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, and so on. Know in verse 25, therefore, and understand that from the going forth of the word to restore and build Jerusalem, the decree of Darius Astapses, to the coming of an anointed one, a prince, there shall be 7 weeks. And we know by comparing a day for a year and looking at the historical records that have been preserved that the day for a year principle works out with the information that we're given here in Daniel chapter 9. There are other passages, however, where perhaps it's more subjective, but we still have some indication that a day for a year is a principle that God intends us to interpret it, to interpret the prophecy. In Revelation, we have in Revelation chapter 2 a statement about persecution, tribulation. In Revelation chapter 2, the ecclesia at Smyrna is told, verse 10, "Do not fear what you are about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to throw some of you into prison, and you may be tested, and for 10 days you will have tribulation." Now, we would hardly speak of a period of tribulation in terms of 10 days. A period of tribulation which lasts 10 years would seem to be more reasonable. And we know, of course, that there was a period between 110... Well, in fact, there was a period lasting in which, under the Emperor Trajan, on the basis of a day for a year, a 10-year period which the believers were indeed very severely tried and experienced tribulation. So although we cannot be absolutely certain that the time in Daniel chapter 7 is a 360-day period, nor can we be absolutely certain that a day for a year is the principle on which we should interpret this prophecy, there doesn't seem to be any other explanation of this prophecy which has such marked indications as does this principle when we apply it to the passage in Daniel chapter 7. Now, it's remarkable because this comes out to 1260 days, which on the day for a year principle, of course, would be 1260 years, in which this papal horn would wear out the saints of the Most High. Now think of these figures. If you take the year 533, and of course we're not told in Daniel what the starting date ought to be, but here are some interesting figures. In 533, the Emperor Justinian declared that the bishop of Rome was superior to all other bishops, and he was given the title of the universal bishop. About 1260 years later, we have the French Revolution and the tremendous persecution of the papists which occurred then. In 549, Justinian decrees Rome freed from the Goths is to be left to the Pope's authority, and the Pope would control the municipal and provincial governments. 1260 years later, approximately, Napoleon annexes the Papal States. 590, Gregory I, the great pope, who issues the new era of the papacy, 1260 years later, Pope Pius IX is driven into exile. In 600, the decree of Phocas was issued, but 1260 years later, two-thirds of the papal states were lost to Italy. The decree of Phocas, in which Justinian's the earlier decrees were really reinforced, 1260 years later, we find the end of the papal dominion. The temporal power of the papacy terminates. And so you can see that the 1260 year period, if we do accept the day for a year principle, seems to be significant in terms of grandiose pronouncements in which the papacy arrogates to itself authority that God never intended to have. And then we see these terminal points 1260 years later when the papacy suffers marked reversals. But brothers and sisters, very interesting for our consideration of 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 is a feature of this prophecy that deals with the uprooting of the three horns. And at this stage, we wish to give some attention now to these three horns that were uprooted in the coming to power of the papal horn. Now, if you remember, we have what we think is a connection in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, because 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 spoke of a restraining force, a restraining power. In verse 7 of 2 Thessalonians 2, "For the mystery of lawlessness is already at work. Only he who now restrains it will do so until he is out of the way." Now, this is very difficult language to understand in the authorized version of the Bible. But if we can think about this expression, it reads, "For the mystery of lawlessness is already at work." That's the apostasy. "Only he," that is God, "who now restrains it, will do so until he," whatever the restraining influence might be, the restrainer, "is taken out of the way." Well, in Daniel chapter 7, there was a reason why the papal horn, in coming to power, had to uproot three horns before this ecclesiastical power could exercise a political influence. Now, I'd like to read to you from page 57 of our notes on the man of sin. And you can peruse there at your leisure some of the alternative translations to the authorized version in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. But the translation of the New English Bible reads this way: "Secret only for the present, until the restrainer disappears from the scene. For the secret of lawlessness is already working, only the one restraining for the present shall be out of the way. Of lawlessness, there is only one, the restraining just now, until out of the midst it comes." Now note, after the fall of Augustulus, the last of the Caesars in 476, influence was really exercised from Constantinople, as we've indicated here on this little map. And so we see the political influence is exercised from 476 from Constantinople over here. And this was especially evident with the decretal letter of the Emperor Justinian in 533, to which we've referred, in which the Pope was recognized as the head of all the churches. This was later followed by the Decree of Phocas in 608, which likewise acknowledged the papal see, interesting in terms of the eyes, the papal see, and allowed the pantheon to be used by the papacy. And so Gibbon the historian comments as follows: "Like Thebes or Babylon or Carthage, the name of Rome might have been erased from the earth if the city had not been animated by a vital principle which again restored her to honor and dominion." Now, what he's speaking about here is the fact that this diverse beast, this fourth beast of Daniel chapter 7, was facing its demise at the hands of those ten horn kingdoms, those barbarians, which poured into Rome. And so he says Rome might have been annihilated, become non-existent, if it hadn't been for a vital principle which again restored her to honor and dominion. The temporal power of the popes, their political dominion, insensibly arose from the calamities of the times. And the Roman bishops, who have since deluged Europe and Asia with blood, were compelled to reign as the ministers of charity and peace. The misfortunes of Rome involved the apostolical pastor in the business of war and peace. The foundation of Constantinople marks one of the great periods of change in the annals of the world. The removal of the seat of the empire from Rome and the absence of a secular competition allowed the papal authority to grow up, to develop its strength by the side of the imperial power, constantly repressed in its slow but steady advancement to supremacy. The Pope, in any other city, he would have in vain asserted his descent from St. Peter. So we see then that what we have in this fourth beast of Daniel's prophecy, the ferocious characteristics of the fourth beast continued in the ten-horned era, in the rise of this little papal horn that was going to wear out the saints of the Most High for this 1260-day period, and it would speak things against the Most High. But the papal ambitions were somehow contained by the fact that there were the Heruli and the Ostrogoths and the Lombards who controlled territory for 20 years, for 60 years, for about a 130-year period, which prevented the papacy from assuming a political domination in this area of the Roman Empire. So in order to assume this ascendancy, the papal horn had to uproot these three horns. And so the restraining influence in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 was really paganized Arianism. Now there was a great conflict at this time in the Roman Catholic Church between a bishop Arius and another bishop, Athanasius. And it was really whether Jesus was co-substantial with his father. And they argued, and they argued, until finally they only resolved this issue by the most scandalous violence that resulted in fist fights and the most terrible epithets thrown at each other you can imagine. And you can read of the history of this council convened by Constantine, which formed the Nicene and later the Athanasian creeds. But the Arian people, converts of Arius, were these Heruli, Ostrogoths, and Lombards, so inimical to the Pope, who really supported Athanasius. And as we know today, nearly all of Christendom is united on the belief of the Athanasian Creed. And the Pope threw in his lot with the Athanasian view of the Godhead, that Jesus was co-substantial, co-eternal, and co-equal with his Father. And so the papal horn could obviously dominate and influence the ten horns that thought like Athanasius, or the seven horns that thought like Athanasius. But the papal horn could never assume its political power until it uprooted these three obnoxious Arian horns, the Heruli, the Ostrogoths, and the Lombards. And these Christianized pagans, these Arian pagans, contained the papacy for this period of time until the man of sin became evident, and then he assumed this political domination over the Roman Empire, in which he could then wear out the saints of the Most High that were given into his hand for this period of time. And so you see, brothers and sisters, there's a connection between Daniel chapter 7 and the three horns that are plucked up by the roots, so that this papal head, with its eyes and mouth, could exercise its dominating influence, an ecclesiastical and a political horn, over the rest of the horn powers on the Roman beast. And we see a continuity. We see the characteristics of this terrible, ferocious beast that stamped and broke in pieces the residue with its teeth of iron and claws of bronze flowing through the ten-horned phase of the beast and culminating, as it were, in the stout little horn that warred against the saints and spoke great things against the Most High. Now, it's a very interesting undertaking to sit down and compare now the features of this little horn in Daniel 7 with 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. You can see that in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, the man of sin exalts himself above every so-called god or object of worship. The little horn in Daniel chapter 7, he shall speak words against the Most High. The power in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 opposes. It's powerful. It's dominating. In Daniel chapter 7 we read, it shall wear out the saints of the Most High, but only for a period of time. Because the little horn dominion, we read, will experience a time when his dominion shall be taken away to be consumed and destroyed to the end. And we know that the papal system will be destroyed by the breath of his mouth and by the brightness of his appearing. And so 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 provides valuable insights and background information for Daniel 7. Daniel 7 provides a broader exposition of 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 and some of its details. And so Paul can refer to the prophecy of the apostasy in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 in terms of what he used to tell the Thessalonians when he was with them. Was he expounding the intent of Daniel chapter 7 to these believers? And so we look in our conclusion, brothers and sisters, of this little horn of Daniel chapter 7 with the conclusion that we have here depicted on this overhead. If we could have the lights out, please. Here we see Pope Stephen soliciting aid from Papen. He implored Papen to defend him against the Lombards. And we have this inscription at the bottom, which I think is a very appropriate description of Daniel 7 and 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. The invariable policy of the church, when the Rome has dared, she has been insolent and defiant. When she has been firmly opposed, she has ever been crouching and servile. She has been the slave, the rebel, the usurper by turns, licking the dust beneath the feet of kings, or plunging the dagger into their hearts. So is the character of the little horn of Daniel chapter 7, which by the grace of God will only wear out the saints of the Most High until this time period had been completed. And then God would give reprieve to his saints, and the dominion of this great apostate system would be taken away, consumed, and destroyed to the end. And now, brothers and sisters, we look to the age when the kingdom and the dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High.